Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Tonight we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score which would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats Football History and its Memorabilia on the Sports History Network. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. And I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be the host for your show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We'll cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Lord. He has, from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to our all-new podcast.
I love it. Bob, how many shows have we done? How many years have I heard you do that intro? This is the first time I've seen you do it. And I was just sitting here, just overjoyed, just laughing, just loving it, just watching you look down at your script and football. I love it.
I am in the modern 21st century now. We have gone and crossed the border. We are 9 years in to the most advanced show we are ever doing. And it's our initial show on the Sports History Network, and I'd like to thank Sports History Network for getting us on and being one of the podcasts here. It's a great network, so many different shows to listen to, great podcast hosts, great guests on all levels of sports and all the different areas of sports, not just football. And I highly recommend that if you can listen to any of their podcasts, you won't be disappointed in what you hear. But we haven't been on for a few months since we're doing this changeover, and this is our initial show. So we'll probably have a few bumps in the road today, but we're going to work them over and make sure they work. It's enjoyable actually seeing our two different setups. This is just one part of the man cave up here in Southport, and I know I've heard about this stuff. I have seen a few things they posted over the years, but it's cool to see them in your domain there, and you can call upon them and what you're looking at and so on and so forth.
I just moved offices, so I still haven't quite unpacked yet. So I still have, you know, like uncut sheets and stuff on the floor. I doubt I'll show you around because I'm a little embarrassed for house guests, but I haven't, I've been down here for about 2 months. I haven't had a chance to hang stuff up. So I kind of put my favorite stuff behind me and call it a day.
Believe it. Hey, it's going on 2 years, believe it or not. We're almost here and I'm still not unpacked with everything. I'm still going through a lot of things. And my problem, which is not really a problem, is I still need another bookcase and another display. For lack of a better term, a display area that I'm trying to think about what I'm actually going to do to set up stuff and show stuff. And also streamlining a lot of the stuff I own and what I want to highlight, so on and so forth. So it's a work.
Your background makes you look very intelligent. Books. You're a learned man, Mr. Swick.
That's my one and only bookcase right now, believe it or not, which is jammed with books and different areas of and small pieces of memorabilia that I have on display. But again, getting back, we've been off the air for several months. We're back on. We're going to be hopefully doing this weekly with the guests, and we're doing it a little differently with actually having video this time. And it should be a fun experience again, back into the swing of things. I want to start off by saying, initially, we are on press with Gridiron Greats issue number 82. Hopefully, it will be in the mail. I don't think it's going to be the end of this week, but probably the beginning of next week, our copies will be mailed out. And again, if you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine, what are you waiting for? GridironGreatsMagazine.com. So Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. Give me a little background on what I'm seeing, if anything you want to talk about.
Was, as I've mentioned quite a few times on the show, I'm an avid uncut sheet collector. So right there is one of my favorites, 1957 Topps uncut sheet, a partial sheet. I did an article on it in Gridiron Greats probably, what, 5-6 years ago on how on the set, basically. And hopefully made Zeke Bratkowski a household name with the 57 set. But just delved into the layout of the sheet and how it was issued. So the longtime myth was that it was issued in two sets, and just how it was laid out to kind of disproves that. Right there, some of my wax pack collection, some of my favorites in there. I have a couple more that I haven't put in there yet, including this 52 Topps, or 52 Bowman large pack. It's GAI. It's a little tough on the back, but it was probably the best example I had. It's the one, starts with one series in GAI, which is when Mike Baker was there. So it's a little more reputable. One of these days I'll send it in and get it crossed over. But until then, it kind of sits here. It'll join that later on. I bought a second case with the intent of putting them in chronological order. So just some of my favorite uncut sheets. You can see right there is a 65 Topps Tall Boy uncut or wax pack. Bob, that's in honor of you.
A lot of memories with that wax pack, as you know, and some of our audience knows. That was one of the first wax packs I ever bought, along with the 65 Philly, which you graciously picked up one for me many, many years ago at the National. And we did dinner that year, and I knew in a way it was a repack. But
I know.
It's not uncommon for buying raw wax packs that they are resealed and they're repacked, so on and so forth.
That was a GAI, because I remember opening it, releasing it from its plastic tomb for you, and you open it. I mean, and you know how those packs are collated. So, I mean, it's just there's one that slipped by the goalie, the GAI goalies. So, this is a Jim Thorpe. It's an artist drawing of him from a game in 1911 or 1912. And that's the lineup of the game. And then one of my favorite things right here is my 1948 Leaf. It's a partial uncut sheet. It's missing two cards. It's cut in half. So I have it kind of laid together in the frame so that it appears as one sheet, even though it's two partial sheets from two different sheets, because there was one card that overlapped, one card in each half that was the same. So that told me they're from two different sheets uncut. So I cut that card out of one of them so that they fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. So
I'm just curious, as you're setting up and you get finished, with your office and everything, how many sheets are you going to actually frame and try to hang up? I mean, you're going to be top to bottom with sheets, or what do you think?
Yeah, I usually stack them 2 to 3 high. I have all four 1950 Bowman uncut sheets, A through D series. Those are much smaller, so I'm able to stack them, stack them on top of each other together. But generally too high for the normal 132 card sheets. And too high, one kind of, and then around the horn. At my last office, I had 12 hung, plus autographed, Sports Illustrated cover of Marcus Mariota, the Oregon Duck Heisman winner. Some concert tickets, Just some various, football collectibles. You walk into my office, you immediately know I'm a person who collects football memorabilia. There's no doubt about it.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
And it's vintage and it's pure. It's what I to say the least.
A few shots for you sitting here. 1976 wax pack I just bought. This is a type one photo of Red Grange that I like. Came with this one, which is an image from the Shotwells, where he's running behind that brick, with the brick wall in the back. So type one photo of him running. And then I finally picked up a, I'm working on my monster I've mentioned, which is a ticket stub and a program from every college game Red Grange played in.
Right.
And that was from October 20th, 1923, Illinois beat Iowa 9-6. Red Grange scored the sole touchdown of the game. And it's getting down and down to the nitty gritty. There's about 12, programs and tickets.
It's just amazing to me that, and we've talked about this numerous times over the years, the rarity of older tickets and programs. And, some of it is appreciated in the hobby and some of it is just totally ignored. And I still, again, I know I'm a dinosaur in the hobby and I know I'm not, I'm not big on grading and not big on that kind of stuff, but I'm just kind of shocked how, especially publications, pre-war publications, are just ignored and they're overlooked in the hobby to a large degree. And even now, looking at a lot of 1940s, 50s, and 60s publications, they continue to be ignored, so on and so forth. It just truly amazes me.
Agree more. I know this is kind of interesting, but an article that Carl Amadella wrote in Gridiron, 10, 12 years ago, where he talked about how rare some of these were. First of all, how many people attended this game in 1923?
Right.
How many people bothered to save a program after the game? How many of them survived fires, floods, insects in attics? How many survived just getting thrown out as people passed away? And, their kids came in and went, what the hell is this? Who would care about a program? And then the big thing that I always forgot about was paper drives from the war. This is 1923. I mean, what, 18 years later, we'd be at war, with Japan and Germany, and paper drives were huge. And as he described it, the voracious vacuum of war paper drives, people, rummaging through trying to look for any and all paper. So, I mean, if 30,000, 40,000 people attended the game, I mean, who knows how many, because this is, oh my gosh, this is Saturday, October 20th, 1923.
Wow.
We are October 16th. In 4 days, this program will be 100 years old, Bob.
Wow.
I never even thought about that. Isn't that fascinating? I just put two and two together that 1923, 100-year-old program. Think about that.
Paper drives. The one thing that really amazes me is especially 1940, roughly to 1944, any actual publications that were printed at that time, I don't know how they survived, because those in many cases were recycled, for lack of a better way of explaining it, into the paper drive, and therefore they were gone completely, type of thing.
Totally.
So it was really amazing to see what actually survives or doesn't survive. And that's why I'm always, I chuckle when people say, I'm looking for a pristine copy of a 1940 annual. I said, I don't know how many are out there. I'm sure they're out there. But I don't know what to tell you, because I don't know, where they are, and so on and so forth, type of thing. So it's interesting to see people's perceptions, and then trying to educate them on it. It becomes challenging, to say the least.
Couldn't agree more. I love it. There was an auction about a year and a half ago, where somebody inherited their great uncle's coffee table. And what they didn't know is there were drawers in the coffee table. Nobody knew. And so they opened the drawers up, and inside it were like two pristine programs from 1920, 1930. I forget what games they were, but they're like, you won't find a more pristine. I mean, these came home from the game and they were probably put in this drawer. Yeah. So yeah, at some point, as we've talked about, you know, you're almost agnostic to condition, just owning a piece of this. I mean, I'm getting down to where I don't have that many programs and ticket stubs I need. I'm good with a torn ticket stub. I'm good with anything. I mean, if I came across the three or four that I'm missing from 1923 programs, and it was just the front page, I'd probably buy that and call it a day.
Yeah, I believe it.
Some of these are getting pretty rare.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the stuff you're looking for is exceptionally rare. And, you know, how many times have you actually seen it come up? Yep. And, you know, you get involved in a bidding war. You know, how much do you really want to pay for something, so on and so forth? It's all in the perspective of how we collect what we're looking at. Again, you're a pure collector. So what you are collecting is what you know, you want that ticket stub, you want the actual program, you want the full piece. But in some cases, as we both know, we've had to settle for second, third best just to say that we had a type of thing. And that's something to understand in our hobby. We're more interested in the history behind the item rather than the PSA 11 or 12 grade it's going to come out at. You know, if we choose to get it graded. What, you know, I got a few things that are just popping into my mind, but the one thing I was amazed at this national was how many Sports Illustrators are now graded and they're in slabs. And what I don't understand is, and I was explained to me, you buy one copy you can read and you buy one copy where you have it graded and you keep it in the slab. So I said, well, then you got two copies of the item. What is the point of having those two items? Why aren't you satisfied with just the one item that you can read? But again, it's becoming more of a show thing that, you know, you want the graded item, so on and so forth. It just defies logic to me, you know. And again, it goes back to my dinosaur image. You know, why would you read and put in a slab a magazine that you're never going to read again? I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but then
you're
supposed to have two copies of it, so on and so forth.
Okay. Every one of these programs that I get, I take them out and I read them. And I love reading the old advertisements where it's like, an old Cadillac dealership or a suit maker, you know, hey, have coal delivered to your house. It is so fun to read some of the old adverts, you know?
Yeah, it just amazes me. I mean, but again, you want to read the information. It's historical. I love reading older programs. They're just so fascinating to me. They're so great to read and view. And so, it's just amazing. I'm going to touch base again with the uncut sheets. And your uncut sheets, I consider you an expert on uncut sheets. And let's go right now. And since we've mentioned it several times, what are the sheets you are actually looking for? Because now we got a completely different audience watching and listening to us. So, perchance, get it out there.
Well, the white whale would be a 1935 Chickle, you know, uncut sheet. I mean, obviously, I tried to piece together even how it was built. You know, there was a Gridiron podcast we did where I got, you know, Skybird sheets. I got, you know, all the other sheets that Chickle put together, and found how they were put together by finding partial uncut sheets that had sold, and just, it was random. It was pure random. I mean, you try to go by color because like 1968 to 1965, 1968 and 69 top sheets were collated by color. So, I mean, they could put more ink in one spot, not in another. Everything else, you know, none of the other ones, you know, some of them you'd see by, you know, by number, like in 48 leaf, it's by number, you know, 1 through 49, seven by seven, you know, sheet series, you know, series A, series B. I don't know how a 35 Chickle sheet is put together. There's no miscuts. Like, I was able to put together how this 48 leaf sheet was laid out, because there's so many miscut cards, you're able to see, you know, what the next card over was on a lot of miscuts. So even before this came up on eBay, I had an idea of how it was laid out. And then when I came across it, that validated it. Still have no idea how a 35 chicle sheet is laid out. It would be fascinating. And it's because they talk about, you know, one of a series of, what was it? I mean, I forget what the back of a chicle card says, you know, but, you know, one of a series of 130 or 100, I forget what the number is, but, you know, that, you know, they fell one third short of that is, right. You know, was it because, you know, sales were poor? I mean, who knows? 35 chicle sheet is obviously the white whale. A 52 Bowman large sheet would be amazing. I've only seen one uncut sheet that you know, and I didn't see it because it went for sale in like 2002. I saw an article written on it. I spoke to the gentleman who wrote the article and asked where the sheet was, and he said he sold it in a private transaction like 2 years after he wrote the article. Yeah. I've got the article only in black and white. I've laid out how that sheet is collated. Yeah. It would be great to get an uncut, you know, 52 large. I'll take a 52 small. I mean, heck, it's a cool sheet.
Right.
I think that'd probably be the top two. Second series of 48 leaf would be cool because there's so many rare cards on there. Then you start getting into the, the Concrete Charlie, Charlie Bednarik, Charlie Connerly's on there. You start to get a lot of really, really tough cards on the second series.
It's interesting. And I was collecting the 48 leaf set. I never honestly saw any second series that were better than VG condition.
Yep.
Had this discussion numerous times too. It's amazing to me how many mint 48 leaf high numbers came out of nowhere.
Yep.
It took me literally 20 years to put that set together. And I just never saw, I saw low numbers, but I never saw anything in the high 48.
Well, think about it. The Charlie Connerly, the highest grade of that card is a PSA 7. Yep. And I think there's two of them. I mean, you're lucky to find it in a 6.
Yep.
And it's because the sheet is numbered. If you flip it over to the obverse, then it goes left to right.
Okay.
So if you're looking at it straight away, it's going right to left. So his sheet would be upper left. His card, Charlie Connor, would be upper left corner, which I always refer to as the pole position, because it's the one that gets guided into the rails. You know, we don't know how they cut these. We assume they use, you know, either a knife blade or, you know, they had roller cutters at the time.
Especially in 1948, you still were doing hand cutting.
Yep.
Paper.
And the way the striations look on the 48 leaf cards, you can tell that they were probably cut using a knife cutter manually. So you've got people lining it up on a rail, cutting. So that card, you know, is the one that gets banged up against the rail, you know, for that first initial cut.
Yeah.
That's why it's pretty rare. It'd be pretty interesting.
All right. So those are the big two and three for you.
Yep.
35, so, 52 large and 48 leaf second series. So
but most importantly, a 35 chicle. That'd be, I'd have to, you know, sell some blood to start saving up for that.
So if you have it out there, contact us and we'll take it from there.
Look at this face. Don't you want to make me happy and find me an uncut sheet? So, all right, Captain, right back at you. I see some newspaper articles. I see a lot of books that make you look very intelligent. And I see you've shared this with me before, but that photo of a player in red, in a red jersey over your right shoulder. You've explained it to me before. I forget the story. What do you got? What's in your background?
All right. Well, I have a couple pictures. You're talking about the Kansas City Chief guy, 73.
No, there's a red photo over your right shoulder.
Over my right shoulder.
Is that a card or is that a photo? That, yes, sir.
So this is Nick Aglioretti, number 73 of the Kansas City Chiefs. I am friends with his father, Carl, and I will go on record in saying they are both readers of Gridiron Greats magazine, and he enjoys it. And he sent me several things autographed, and there's a guy who is a number six man for the Chiefs. He fills in on the line, both offense and defensive lines when needed. And he's got two Super Bowl rings in his career already.
That'll do.
Great guy, great family. And I got several autographed pictures of him in my collection.
That's fun.
Trying to think.
Years ago, we were all texting back and forth about something. And I saw that. You explained that. Now I remember.
I got it. And then I need to be set up a little better here, but we're learning.
Remember those ESPN commercials where they were, you know, joking around and they had an announcer there in a suit, and then they cut and he's actually living in his parents' attic and he stands up and he's just wearing shorts and a fake tie.
Yeah. Yeah. This is him with his first Super Bowl.
Oh.
That's a nice pick, too.
That's really good. That's really good.
This is a small part of my book collection here. I have about 300 hardcover and softcover books. This is only part of it. And like I said, I really need another bookcase to try to display everything, so on and so forth. And this side over here is mainly all my Packer publications and books, my media guides, my yearbooks. Believe it or not, in the drawers of this bookcase, I have all my Packer programs, with the exception of the Super Bowl programs that I have over here. So next show, I'm going to be set up a little differently so I can have more visuals. And the newspaper articles from the Meriden Record Journal paper when we were living in Wallingford, Connecticut, they did a feature on my collection and myself.
Oh, cool.
And there was another article they did on me when the Packers were in the Super Bowl, the one and only Super Bowl of Aaron Rodgers. I had a party at our house. We invited people over. I invited the reporter over. I said, there's going to be free food and drinks, so you might as well come over because I know you're a starving journalist. So she had a good laugh. So she came over. But believe it or not, right down the street, about two blocks over, there was a Pittsburgh Steelers party going on. So she went back and forth. And she said they were pretty depressed in the second half, so they came back to our house because we were winning, and they ended up staying. And then I gave her a plate to go along with the photographer, and I said, here's some extra food for you. I knew she had to go write the article. And the next morning, I stopped. I would always stop, get coffee and the paper before I drove to work. I had a half-hour commute plus to work. So I'd always buy a large coffee and buy a couple of days. I would always buy the New York Post and the local paper, and then I would read it at work, so on and so forth. So they did an article on that also. But
that's cool.
I'm laying low. I'm not advertising this that much. There's only certain people that know. We publish the magazine and have seen the collection here. So, but where the development I actually live in, and there are several former college players who live here. I've been in touch with a couple of them. I'm going to try to get them on the show. Actually come here and we can do the interview from the man cave up here and talk about their careers, so on and so forth. So it's interesting. It's interesting. But and I showed you numerous times the binder wall of all the run. That'll be for another show.
Which really scratches my OCD itch, seeing it all organized and labeled like that, Captain. I love it.
So it's I'm happy in this man cave compared to my old man cave in the other house. It's much more roomy. And I got a lot more room for on my walls to hang stuff. And I'll show you all my autograph stuff at another show. The other man cave I had was downstairs, but I had sliding doors in there, so that took up a lot of the wall space. So I lost the whole section of the room because of the sliding doors, which I didn't realize once I set up the room there, but it was what it was, type of thing. But that had built-in bookcases there, so I had more room to display. So I had everything out in that man cave as compared to this one. But in any event, what's my favorite saying? Football, 365, 24/7, or 24/7, 365, football. And it's our time of the year, our time of the season. And I'm just going to touch base because we're getting close. We have a different time structure in this podcast for our regular listeners, but we're going to be doing it more frequently. We're not limited to certain time structure. We can go over, we can go under, whatever the case may be. And like I'm telling everybody, this is going to be our test podcast, and see how this goes, and should be a take. But before we go, our topic today was going to be the top five football cards that we both like, appreciate. But we're going to do something different.
Your favorites.
We're going to do something different today because of time. We're only going to talk about number five and number four.
Ooh.
And our next show, we'll do our top three. So I'm going to hand off to you for your number five, and then I'll give you my number five. I didn't pull them though. I'm going to have to say them, and I will go back and I'll pull them afterwards for the next show.
Okay. I'm just going to share something real quick here. We all remember this.
Yep.
Your Mount Rushmore of cards. And there was a Jim Brown card in there. And I basically went with another card that's one of my favorites. So my I kind of took them by year. I will admit, I took a Wheel of Fortune approach to this. You know how in Wheel of Fortune they give you let me get rid of this. Okay. You know how in Wheel of Fortune, you know, they give you the RST, LNE, and then you have to pick your favorite consonant and vowels after that.
Yeah.
So I kind of went, you know, right down the, what's the Mount Rushmore of cards? The 35 Chickle Nagurski, the 58 Tops Jim Brown, the 65 Tops Joe Namath, and the 57 Tops Unitas or Star, along with the 77 top Steve Largent that I photoshopped in there. So I kind of said, I'm going to treat those as the Wheel of Fortune. And then I'm going to pick the cards that meant a lot to me. And obviously the 1977 Topps number 177 Steve Largent rookie card, I brought that in at number five to me. That is has become almost synonymous with me. It's almost become a gag, you know, where I one time I wondered how many Largent rookie cards I had. It was over 1,000, and I laid them out on my poker table. And I think I've shared this before, but I laid it out on my poker table. Hang on, let me bring this up real quick. I don't know if I have shared this before, but excuse me as I navigate. I didn't have that up.
I'll fill in the audience on.
There we go. This was me laying out part of my Largent rookie card collection on my poker table. And whenever people talk about OCD and collecting and this and that, that's the picture that I post up as kind of a gag. After that, my number four, this might be a surprise to you, but a very meaningful card to me is the 1961 Fleer card number 11, Jim Brown.
Okay.
I know it's odd, but 61 Fleer is one of my favorite sets. It's by far my favorite FLIR set. I really love the photos, the background on there. I mean, a lot of Franklin Field in there. And it's broken into two series, with series one being the NFL and series two being the AFL. The Jim Brown rookie card is incredibly hard to find. A PSA 9 in it, I don't know what the population is, but it's not very much. PSA 8, there's about 70 of them. But in PSA 9, incredibly hard to find. I was putting the 61 FLIR set together, 9, and I never found one. One just sold in an auction about a month ago for $6,000, 7,200 with VIG. So $7,000 card for his third, just an innocuous set, 61 FLIR. So that rounds out my 5 and 4. Largent rookie card and 61 FLIR number 11 Jim Brown.
Well, one story about the Largent rookie card, and I am not kidding you, and I've told you this story several times. I would be set up at shows, and guys would ask me, do you have any 1977 football cards? I said, yeah. And immediately, and I'll never forget, there was a show. I used to do a small local show in Plainville, Connecticut. I had three guys that day working on the 77 set, and they all said to me, do you have a Largent rookie in any condition? I can't find one anywhere. And I said, well, I know a guy who's got quite a few of them. Let me see if I can get. And they said, no, I don't want it graded. I want to rock, I'm putting it in, 9-pocket sheets type of thing. Yeah, I said, I get it. So what I did from that day on, when I was at a show, and if I did see a ungraded Largent rookie, I would buy it no matter what condition it would be. Because they were rare, knowing that you had pretty much most of the inventory back in your house there. But anyways.
It is kind of embarrassing.
And that's great. And I still have your ornament you made. It's hanging on my...
I made Christmas ornaments for some of us collectors last year, right? Took some of my low-grade Largent rookie cards that are graded, drilled a hole in them, and made them an ornament, a Christmas tree ornament, and then mailed them to some friends.
I was pretty honored to get one. I thought that was pretty cool. That's a nice... is a nice niche. My number five card, surprisingly enough, is the 55 All-American for Horsney. I've always liked that card.
Great.
The last card it took me to find. I obviously do not have it in the greatest condition, but that card finished my 55 All-American set. I like that 55 All-American set. I love the color. Yep. That was another 20-year deal putting the set together as I got older. I remember one of the first few 55 All-American cards I got probably in the mid-1980s. And at that time, I had my one of my first Beckett guides, which at that time it was football, basketball, hockey, boxing all together. So you only had a limited amount of football sets, but I knew the 55 All-American was in it.
Oh.
I was just fascinated. And once I found a couple in... real cards, and I bought them. I said, well, this is a cool set. I got to put this together. So that's number five on my hip parade. Number
four. Iconic set, by the way. There's 5-6 other cards in that set you can name. The Thorpe, the Grange, the Hudson. I mean.
It's a historical set. I mean, you have really historical players in it. You have a lot of greatness there. And to me, the Four Horsemen is, classic football, vintage football history, as far as I'm concerned.
The Bowman Killer set, 1955 Topps AA.
It's a great set. Great set.
There's no 56 Bowman set because of that 55 AA set.
Yep. My number four card is a card dear to me for the 1967 Philly set, the Bart Starr card. Love it. The brown background, I thought it was the coolest thing when they issued those. And again, distinctly for me, the 3 years that I can just envision buying the packs of cards, 65, 66, and 67. 1965 to 67, the Philadelphia cards for the NFL, 65 tall boys for the AFL, 66 AFL, and 67 AFL tops.
Yeah.
Just classic. And the one thing I vaguely remember somehow in 65 or 1966 or 67, I don't remember what year, one of the places I used to buy my packs from, he found in the back room some older packs, and he had a 64, I distinctly remember it was a 1964 Philadelphia pack. So he says, I'm going to sell you this. It was a nickel. I said, I never saw a 1964 card. So I said, I'll buy the pack. And I distinctly remember buying and opening up that pack. I don't remember, however, what cards I actually got out of it. And then when I, back in the 70s and early 80s, when I started really getting into my sets and collecting them, I found those with my other Philly cards. And I started putting the set together with them. And it was just classic.
I love the yellow border on the 67 Philly. That card is iconic. I mean, I do love the borders on the 65 and 67 Phillies are my favorite. Probably the 67, because it was the first Philly set that I completed. But yeah, love the colors. Just so vibrant on that set.
I always said to myself, I would like to go back for whatever reason and just keep putting together 64 to 67 Philly sets together. I probably have half of each set, and I do have a few stars here and then. I always said to myself, I should just keep going and make up a bunch of those sets, and then just, you know, to say that I, like you with your larger cards, it'd be me with my Philadelphia sets. You know, I'm on my 1967 Philly set I'm putting together type of thing and hoard them. But anyways, our next show we'll get to the top three. But again, I wanted to introduce everybody back into the podcast, get things going again, and we'll take it from there. So, quick 2-minute warning, and for those who haven't heard us, we normally have a quick 2-minute wrap up at the end of the show. Joe, I'm going to hand off to you. What'd you pick up on tonight's show?
I'm still reeling from a Oregon Ducks loss by missed field goal at Husky Stadium, and then followed up the next day with a Seahawk loss. So I'm still reeling a little bit from football, some football losses, but so good to get the show back going with you, Bob. So good to see you in person and to see you in your natural habitat, leaning back in your office chair, your man cave chair, kicking back, just all your memorabilia behind you. I think that's your like I said, that's your natural habitat.
It is. And it's great seeing you again and seeing all your stuff. And I love those uncut sheets. They're beautiful. I'm not reeling from anything because the Packers didn't play this week, so they didn't have a chance to lose one way or the other. I did see a couple painful games yesterday, one being the Panthers and the Dolphins, because I watched the Panthers are on every game down here. And that was just a brutal game to watch. And then I found a great interest in the Eagles-Jets game, seeing the Jets pull that off and actually win the game. I thought that was
The last two undefeated teams went down. Larry Zonka and Bob Greasy. Larry Zonka posted on Twitter that he was at the game, the Dolphins game, with Bob Greasy. And he posted on Twitter, he goes, another year down, another year we can rest easy.
That's cool. And I did catch the highlights of the Browns San Francisco game, and that was amazing how he shanked it at the end. He could have won the game, and that's it. On any given Sunday, you never know.
Any given Sunday, indeed. Yep.
You never know what will happen. All right, so that's a wrap, and thanks for watching, and we'll be back next week. Joe, take it easy. I'll see you next week.
You too, Cap. Thank you.
Okay.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.